because fans would know the race was truly a matter of sport. I told them, Vanderbilt continued, you're not running for the money. You're running in the most popular race you could have now. The argument appealed to Riddle and Howard, who probably expected Vanderbilt to offer something in the neighborhood of $75,000. They were in for a shock. The best Vanderbilt could do was $15,000. Vanderbilt was quick to point out to Riddle that $15,000 was exactly the sum of the two purses being offered in War Admiral's scheduled races in New England, at least one of which he'd have to miss to make the match. To reassure each man of his opponent's sincerity, Vanderbilt asked that each put up a forfeit fee of $5,000. Riddle finally responded, I'll race if they'll agree to my terms, but I don't think they will. Vanderbilt asked what those terms were. Riddle was willing to accept the purse, provided that each horse carry 120 pounds. He wanted starter Jim Milton booted out in favor of George Cassidy, the starter for War Admiral's home track, Belmont. Finally, fearing that War Admiral would exhaust or injure himself fighting a conventional starting gate, and wanting to take advantage of his horse's skill at breaking from a walk, Riddle insisted that the race be started from an antiquated, gateless walk-up. The first demand was no problem. Howard would surely appreciate a relatively low and equal impost. The second was more difficult. Vanderbilt didn't want to be strong-armed into dismissing Milton, whom he and virtually all observers agreed had done nothing wrong in his effort to load War Admiral in the gate the year before. But Milton, upon learning of Riddle's wishes, solved the problem for him. He came to Vanderbilt and recused himself from the race. He knew that if War Admiral broke poorly, he would be accused of carrying out a grudge against Riddle. Vanderbilt accepted his decision, and Riddle got his wish. The third demand seemed impossible to fulfill, because horses who gain commanding early leads in match races generally win them. Observers thought the bullet-breaking War Admiral held a considerable advantage over the historically slower-breaking Seabiscuit. Even with a conventional start, with a walk-up, War Admiral would have the added edge of performing a start at which he was superb and experienced, while Seabiscuit would be trying it for the first time. There was almost universal agreement that if War Admiral broke from a walk-up, he would lead from wire to wire. But the issue was a deal-breaker for Riddle. Vanderbilt had no choice but to put it before Howard and hope for the best. In New York, where he had been lobbying Riddle in person, Vanderbilt had the proposal with Riddle's demands typed up as a formal contract and sent to Howard. Howard moaned about the walk-up. He called Smith, who mulled it over. The trainer told him to demand that the start be made with a bell, not simply the traditional walk-up flag, and without assistant starters. The jockeys, he said, would have to be able to handle the horses without aid. Howard passed this on to Vanderbilt, who agreed. The contract came back. Howard had signed it and enclosed his $5,000 forfeit fee. With one man down and one to go, Vanderbilt went to seal the deal. He showed up at Riddle's New York hotel room, contract in hand. Riddle was gone. The owner had already departed for the train station, bound for Philadelphia. Vanderbilt jumped into a cab, sped across town, and dashed into Penn Station, where he caught up with Riddle just as he was about to board the train. Riddle was still wavering. Vanderbilt stood his ground and refused to let Riddle board the train until he had signed the paper. Riddle gave in, and Vanderbilt returned to Maryland to cheers from horsemen. The November 1st Pimlico Special, universally hailed as the race of the century, was on. Nothing, this time, was going to stop it from being run. When news of the deal broke to an ecstatic public on October 5th, horsemen were amazed that Howard had accepted the walk-up. One horseman, wrote the New Yorker's Audax Minor, wonders if Riddle forgot to ask for permission to bring his own judges, too. Yet during the negotiations, Vanderbilt had noticed something strange. Howard, who had been loudly and publicly lamenting Riddle's demand for the walk-up, seemed in private to be delighted. Howard loved it, Vanderbilt remembered. He loved it. The reason was Tom Smith. Once again, the old cowboy had something up his sleeve. All along, he had been secretly hoping that Riddle would demand the walk-up. By some accounts, he had actually instructed Howard to make a few protests before ultimately agreeing to it so that no one would suspect his game plan. The best anyone thought Smith could hope for was for Seabiscuit to somehow stay reasonably close to War Admiral in the early stages of the race. Smith was far more ambitious. Sitting on a tack trunk with his friend Bill Buck during the match negotiations, he made an amazing statement. "I'm going to give them birds the biggest surprise they ever had in their lives. I'm going to send Seabiscuit right out on the lead." Pollard was lying on his hospital bed, chatting with David Alexander when the phone rang. It was Wolf, and he wanted to get Pollard's opinion on the match. The Iceman, like virtually everyone else, disagreed with Smith. He thought War Admiral simply had more God-given speed than Seabiscuit, and that the Triple Crown winner would surely beat him off of the line. How, he asked Pollard, should he ride this race? Pollard surprised him. If Wolf put the throttle to the floor right from the bell, he promised him, Seabiscuit would beat War Admiral to the first turn. He told Wolf to gun to the lead, but to keep him in check on the backstretch. When jockey Kurtzinger launched War Admiral in his final drive for the wire, Pollard said, do something completely unexpected and probably unprecedented. Let him catch up. It was a startling plan. Maybe you would call it a kind of horse psychology, Pollard explained to Alexander. Once a horse gives Seabiscuit the old look in the eye, he begins to run to parts unknown. He might loaf sometimes when he's in front and thinks he's got a race in the bag, but he gets gamer and gamer the tougher it gets. Pollard was sure that if Wolf let War Admiral challenge him, Seabiscuit would run faster and try harder than if Wolf tried to hold the lead alone. Seabiscuit is the gamer horse. I know that. From there on in, the instructions were simple. Once War Admiral hooked Seabiscuit, race him into the ground. Everything hinged on two assumptions to which virtually no one outside the Seabiscuit camp would have ever agreed, that Seabiscuit had the speed to beat War Admiral off the line, and that he had enough gameness to fight back and win when his jockey sacrificed his lead. On the first point, Wolf was quickly convinced. The second was more difficult. Pollard knew that what he was asking his friend to do went against every tenet of reinsmanship. Most jockeys would have thought me nuts, he told Alexander after hanging up. When a horse drives on you at a time like that, it just seems logical to drive as hard as you can to stay in front. It's instinct. I tell you that what I told Wolf to do was tough to do. If Pollard was wrong about Seabiscuit, then his strategy would hand the victory to War Admiral. But Wolf recognized that his friend understood the horse better than he did. He came to view the race as Pollard did, as a test of toughness, and had never seen a horse as tenacious as Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit's like a hunk of steel. Solid. Strong, he once said. Admiral has speed. Good speed. Speed when unopposed. But he's not game. Of Seabiscuit, he said, you could kill him before he'd quit. Wolf agreed to do exactly what Pollard told him to do. He and Smith brought Seabiscuit to Pimlico and went to work. On the day after the match race deal was finalized, Smith walked up the Pimlico track to the starter stand. Climbing up to the bell, he rang it several times, studying the sound. It made a clang much like an alarm clock. He hopped down and went back to the barn, where he gathered up some redwood planks, a phone, and an alarm clock. Dismantling the clock and the phone, he rigged up a starting bell with the clock alarm and the telephone's 5-inch batteries, then cut the redwood into a box to hold the works and wired a trigger button to the outside. When the box was complete, Smith tacked up Seabiscuit and Pumpkin, pushed Wolf up onto the former, swung himself onto the ladder, and took them toward the track, carrying the box with him. On most mornings, War Admiral preceded Seabiscuit onto the course. Invariably, hundreds of people fanned out around the track apron to watch the Triple Crown winner, who had come to Pimlico after crushing the field in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. Trainer Conway stood on the sideline and watched his horse from afar as he circled around the course, legging up for the stout 1 3/16 distance of the match. War Admiral was, as always, fretting and fussing and glorious. As War Admiral was led back to Man-O-War's old barn, Conway stepped back to watch Smith and Pumpkin trotting onto the track alongside Seabiscuit and Wolf. Smith took the horses up to the race's starting point at the top of the home stretch. The crowd, which had been thinly dispersed around the track to see War Admiral's distance workouts, migrated up to the turn after Seabiscuit and stood in a thick mass by the rail. Spectators murmured among themselves at Smith's homemade bell. They watched quizzically as Smith lined up his horse, stepped behind him, and hit the bell, sending Seabiscuit into a rocket start. Wolf hustled him deftly, having begun his career booting horses through walk-up match races in Indian country. He knew how to hit the gas on a horse. Most of the time, Wolf would only let the horse fly through a short sprint before pulling him up and circling back for another go. Day after day, Wolf and Smith repeated the drill, sometimes pairing him with Chance View. The homemade bell worked perfectly, and the horse began blowing off the line with explosive power. When the walk-ups were over, Smith would take the horse back to the barn. Just as always, in the afternoons, most of the Eastern Seaboard streamed into the barn to stare at Seabiscuit. Smith didn't seem to mind. "Can't hurt a horse looking at him," he said. Smith probably did think you could hurt Seabiscuit by looking at him, which is why he made sure that the horse they were all gawking at was Grog. For the next month, America hung in midair. The names War Admiral and Seabiscuit were on everyone's lips. Stories on the horses were in every paper, and the inflamed division between the horses' supporters broadened and deepened into a fanatical contest of East versus West. One reader became so furious when journalist Nelson Dunstan switched his allegiance from Seabiscuit to War Admiral that he threatened to attack him. "Everybody," Vanderbilt recalled, "cared about it. Even President Roosevelt was swept up in the fervor. A rumor that he was going to denounce one of the horses during a fireside chat made the rounds, but he kept his allegiances secret." "The whole country is divided into two camps," wrote Dave Boone in the San Francisco Chronicle. "People who never saw a horse race in their lives are taking sides. If the issue were deferred another week, there would be a civil war between the War Admiral Americans and the Seabiscuit Americans." As October waned, the tension all over the backstretch heightened. Trainer Conway was a frayed wire, shouting at reporters to get the hell away from his horse. Vanderbilt, also wound up with stress, blew off steam in bruising morning football games with the exercise boys. Smith's perpetual frown deepened. He distracted himself by working hard with Kayak and sent him out to win two more races. Charlie Kurtzinger tried to soothe his wife, who was terrified for him. Charlie had only recently gotten out of the hospital after crashing with a horse at Saratoga in August, and his wife was now so afraid for him that she couldn't bear to be at the track when he rode. The closest she could get to watching him was to sit in the track parking lot in their car. Charlie promised her that if she came to the track to see him ride War Admiral, he'd win it for her. Charles and Marcella Howard were similarly jittery. Marcella slept with prayer beads on her pillow every night and attended Mass every morning. She and Charles hovered by the barns, waiting. They were there one afternoon a few days before the race when a sharp rainstorm brushed over the racing oval. Charles and Marcella stood together, watching the lightning crackle over the Maryland countryside. The storm died out and dispersed, and sunlight broke over the track. Marcella found it comforting. She whispered a poem. "The storm is past, no more repining. Behold, the gentle sun is shining." "Yeah," muttered Charles, "but the track is still too heavy for Seabiscuit." In the track offices, horsemen gathered for the post-position draw. Both horses' handlers wanted the rail, which, if the horse could hold it, would ensure the shortest trip around the track. If Seabiscuit got the rail, the experts believed he might have a glimmer of a chance. If War Admiral got it, they believed the race would be over before it began. War Admiral drew the rail. For Pollard, the days were bittersweet. David Alexander spent time with him and found him in jovial spirits. He was in love, he was about to try to start walking again, and he had been told that by early November he could leave the hospital. His engagement had brought his optimism back, and he was sure he would be able to ride again. A glance at his emaciated body, jutting out at harsh angles from under the sheets, testified to the contrary. He was up to his old pranks, sending a group of frostbitten horsemen on a wild goose chase all over Boston in search of non-existent bull's wool socks. Alexander couldn't get him to be serious. "George," Pollard told him, "we'll probably mess everything up as usual and try to get beaten in the nose. But even George isn't bad enough to beat Seabiscuit in this one." But as he spoke, the pain of his situation pressed through to the surface. "Maybe I'm conceited and maybe I'm not, but there still isn't anybody that can ride him like I can ride him," he said. "I can't tell you why. I just know how, and he wants to run for me. I know that the minute I throw a leg over him, morning or afternoon." It looked for a while like I'd come out of here with a set of crutches as permanent equipment. Even if I'd have to use crutches, I still could have ridden the Biscuit. Maybe I couldn't ride any other horse, but I could have ridden him as long as there was somebody to shove me in the saddle. Before Alexander and Pollard parted, the redhead gave him a prediction. Seabiscuit, he said, was going to win by 4. The War Admiral camp remained supremely confident. Conway quietly built his colt's endurance. Every day he lingered by the rails to watch Seabiscuit's peculiar regimens, following his movements without comment, then returned to War Admiral. Everyone in the Riddle Barn knew Smith was trying to coax early speed from Seabiscuit, but the idea of a horse outbreaking War Admiral was unimaginable. "I don't think Seabiscuit will give him much trouble," Jockey Kurtzinger said. "And I don't care if Wolf elects to try to make a race of it. The Admiral will lick him any part of it." The Howard Barn preferred that their opponents keep thinking that way. They remained cryptic about strategy. Smith did little more than make a few grunts about Seabiscuit having good speed. Asked if War Admiral would set the pace, Marcella was coy. "That depends on whether or not he can outrun Seabiscuit in the first furlongs," she said. "Maybe he can't." Pollard went right ahead and lied to reporters, telling them the barn strategy was to concede the lead to War Admiral and then try to run him down in the home stretch. After listening to Wolf and Pollard discussing strategy, David Alexander asked them if he could state in print that Seabiscuit would outgun War Admiral for the early lead. Both said yes, providing that Alexander didn't quote them directly. "Both fully realized," Alexander wrote later, "that War Admiral's connections would pay no attention at all to the pipe dream of a mere newspaper columnist." So Alexander published the prediction. All it did was inspire a hearty laugh in the press box. The laughter burned Howard. On the day before the race, with all the training done, there seemed no harm in letting people know what he thought. Sitting in the Pimlico clubhouse, surrounded by reporters, Howard made a flat statement. "War Admiral won't outbreak Seabiscuit," he said tersely. "He won't outgame him, and he won't beat him." An uncomfortable silence followed. Someone politely changed the subject. Sometime later that day, Wolf received a telegram. It was from Pollard. "There is one sure way of winning with the Biscuit. You ride War Admiral." Across the country that day, the ballots for year-end honors in thoroughbred racing began arriving in journalists' postboxes. The riders collected them, leaving the spaces for Horse of the Year blank. They would wait until Tuesday evening to fill them in. That night, Baltimore glittered and rang with exuberant pre-race parties, the next day's racegoers singing out, "Maryland, my Maryland," as they passed outside the track. Inside the Pimlico gates, it was hushed. A lone figure walked out onto the Pimlico dirt, clutching a flashlight. It was Wolf. The rainwater had not fully drained from the track, and he was concerned that Seabiscuit might struggle over the dampness. "Biscuit likes to hear his feet rattle," was how he put it. Turning down the lane, the jockey weaved back and forth, sweeping his flashlight beam from side to side, hunting for the driest, hardest path. At the top of the home stretch, Wolf stopped, testing the footing. In the soil beneath his feet, he could feel a firmer strip, the print of a tractor wheel that had lately rolled over the surface. The path was obscured by harrow marks. Walking the full length of the track, Wolf found that it circled the entire oval, a few feet from the rail. He knew what he would have to do when the bell rang the following afternoon. "I figures to myself," he said later, "Wolf, get on that lane and follow it." In the darkness of the last night of October 1938, George Wolf walked the course until he had memorized the path of the tractor print. Then he quietly stepped off the track. "I knew it," he said later, "like an airplane pilot knows a radio beam." Chapter 19. The Second Civil War. Beneath a translucent scrim of clouds at 8 o'clock in the morning on November 1, 1938, Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Jervis Spencer stepped out onto the smoky brown oval of Pimlico. With his hands pushed into the pockets of a gray overcoat, Spencer circled a track on foot, moving by a pallet of colorful barns and turning leaves. Horses galloped past him. Vanderbilt stood in the winner's circle, awaiting the completion of the circuit. The course was rimmed in faces, all eyes on Spencer. Ridlin Howard had agreed that the chairman would be the final judge of the condition of the track. Only if it was dry and fast would the race go. The issue was somewhat in doubt. As Wolf had noted in the darkness the night before, the week's rains had soaked into the dirt. But several days of crisp fall air and heavy labor by Vanderbilt's men had dried the surface well. At 8:30, Spencer stopped outside the winner's circle, looked up at Vanderbilt, and nodded. He turned to a microphone, cleared his throat, and spoke. "In my judgment, there is no question that the track will be fast for the race this afternoon. The race is on." As if somehow linked to the emotions of all present, the sun spilled out, bathing the overcoated men in warm Maryland sunshine. The coats came off and every man headed his own way. Vanderbilt walked out onto the track with a bucket, burning off a little nervous energy by picking up loose pebbles and clumps of dirt. Marcella Howard went off to host a pre-race luncheon. A friend presented her with an exuberant Dalmatian as a gift. They named him Match in honor of the occasion and sent him over to the barn to cavort with Pocatel and Seabiscuit's guard dog, Silver. Up in the track secretary's office, a telegram arrived for Howard. "Please bet $200 for me. Our horse will win by 5. Pollard." Howard placed the bet for him, tossing in $25,000 of his own money for good measure. He went to the backstretch and strolled around with Wolf. Somewhere along the shed rows, they came across sunny Jim Fitzsimmons and stopped to talk about the race. Fitzsimmons liked Pollard's strategy of pushing for the early lead, but like Smith, Wolf, and Pollard, he believed that the match was not going to be determined by speed. The deciding factor would be resolve. One of the horses was going to crack in the home stretch. The other would come home the undisputed champion of American racing. Vanderbilt had hoped that scheduling his race for a Tuesday would keep attendance within Pimlico's 16,000-seat capacity. It didn't. By 10 a.m., 6.5 hours before the race, a vast, agitated throng was already banging up against the fences. Vanderbilt swung the gates open and unleashed a human stampede. All morning long, automobiles and special trains disgorged thousands and thousands of passengers from every corner of the nation and the world. The assembly of foreign dignitaries alone equaled a normal day's attendance. By midday, the grandstand and clubhouse were glutted, so Vanderbilt redirected fans by the thousands into the infield. The crowds kept coming in. At 3:30, the horses began the long walk down the center of the track to the saddling paddock. War Admiral appeared first, spinning around in a white blanket, yellow ribbons in his tail. 2 minutes later, Smith and Pumpkin appeared with Seabiscuit, who was covered to the ears in a red blanket emblazoned with the white H. 30,000 people watched the horses from the grandstand and clubhouse. 10,000 more teamed in the infield, lining up behind a small retaining fence about 10 feet inside the track rail. Dozens of fans bristled over the tops of the steeplechase fences, leaving them teetering under the weight. A thick line of police fanned out to hold the masses back. Outside the track, some 10,000 fans who couldn't get in gathered 10 deep around the track fence and stood upon every rooftop, fence, tree limb, and telephone pole as far as a mile from the start, hoping to catch a glimpse of the race. When the horses arrived in the paddock, they were greeted by the nervous faces of their handlers. The Howards fretted. Riddle looked small and old. Kurtzinger had the inward-focused look of someone at prayer. Saddling began. As Smith cinched the girth of Wolf's kangaroo leather saddle around Seabiscuit's belly, Marcella stepped forward, clutching a medal of St. Christopher, patron saint of travelers. Lifting up the horse's saddlecloth, she pinned the medal to it.
"This will bring you luck," she whispered.
It was All Saints' Day. Into this edgy scene breezed George Wolfe. In dazzling contrast to everyone else at Pimlico, the Iceman was utterly relaxed. A lump of chewing tobacco bulged in his cheek. He strode in, smacked Pumpkin on the rump, swung lightly aboard Seabiscuit, and spat in the air. There was a nervous stir. The bell on the starter stand wouldn't work. The only other official bell at the track was attached to the starting gate. With no other options, the official asked if they could borrow Smith's homemade bell. Smith said yes, and someone fetched the odd redwood box for starter Cassidy, who carried it up to his place at the top of the home stretch. Years later, Daily Racing Form reporter Pete Peterson noted that Tom's eyes were sparkling mirrors when he recalled this incident, making one wonder if the old cowboy had a hand in the bell's demise. Then another snag. Two assistant starters, almost certainly called in by War Admiral's handlers, showed up to lead the horses to the walk-up. Their appearance was in direct violation of the agreement, and Smith spoke up. For once, he wanted War Admiral to be required to behave himself at the post. Smith traded testy words with the officials, and there was a long delay. "No assistance," Smith snapped, "or no race." The assistant starters backed off. At 4 o'clock, the two horses parted a sea of humanity and stepped onto the track before a crowd, wrote Grantland Rice, keyed to the highest tension I have ever seen in sport. Maryland, my Maryland, wafted over a strangely quiet grandstand. The spectators, wrote Rice, were too full of tension, the type of tension that locks the human throat. War Admiral walked up the track first, twirling and bobbing. Blunt-bodied Seabiscuit plodded along behind, head down. He looked up once, scanned the crowd, then lowered his head again. One witness compared him to a milk truck horse. Shirley Povich of the Washington Post thought he exhibited complete, overwhelming, and colossal indifference. The appearance was deceiving. Wolf could feel it. In post-parades, he was accustomed to the smooth levelness of Seabiscuit's walk, the gentle gait of a horse that puts his hooves down carefully. But this day, Wolf felt something new, a gathering beneath him, something spring-like. The horse was coiling up. As the horses strode up the track, NBC radio man Clem McCarthy grabbed his microphone and turned to run to his race-calling post atop the clubhouse. The crowd was so dense that he couldn't get through. He struggled in vain against a current of bodies, then gave up, exhausted. He did the best he could, climbing up on the track's outer rail by the wire and settling in to call the race from there. His voice crackled over the radio waves to an estimated 40 million listeners, including President Roosevelt. Drawn up next to his White House radio, FDR was so absorbed in the broadcast that he kept a roomful of advisors waiting. He would not emerge until the race was over. The reporters massed by the railings in the press box. War Admiral was the toast of the newsmen. Every single Daily Racing Form handicapper had picked him to win, as had some 95% of the other riders. Only a small and militant sect of California riders was siding with Seabiscuit. Down in the stands, the allegiances were more muddied. War Admiral was the heavy favorite in the betting, but reporters mingling in the crowd found that most racegoers were rooting for the underdog. Up in her box, Gladys Phipps gazed down on Seabiscuit with pride. Her hard-tested faith in nasty old hardtack had finally paid off. After Seabiscuit began winning with Smith, the renowned Claiborne Farm, which had once politely but firmly rejected hardtack, changed its mind. Phipps retrieved her stallion from under the mulberry trees at the little farm where she had left him and shipped him to Claiborne, where the managers boosted his stud fee from nothing to a respectable $250. When Seabiscuit took the East by storm, they doubled the fee. Now, as the Biscuit challenged War Admiral, hardtack's fee was $1,000, comparable to that of some of the nation's most prominent sires. Nearby, Fitzsimmons watched the horses. He held a win ticket. It was on Seabiscuit. As the track was 1 mile around and the race 1 mile and 3/16, the starting point was at the top of the homestretch, with the horses set to circle the course roughly 1 1/4 times. As War Admiral walked to the line alongside the flagman and starter Cassidy, Wolf worked to fray the Triple Crown winner's famously delicate nerves. He put Seabiscuit into a long, lazy warm-up, sailing past his skittering rival and galloping off the wrong way around the track. Cassidy ordered him to bring his horse up. "Mr. Cassidy," Wolf called back cheerily, "I have instructions to warm Seabiscuit up before the start." Cassidy barked that he had not been forewarned of this. Wolf shrugged and kept right on going. He and Seabiscuit swung around the far turn and into the backstretch. At the 5/8 pole, Wolf stopped Seabiscuit and turned him toward the grandstand. For a long moment, man and horse stood out on the backstretch. It was quiet. The infield crowds massed up against the rail by the grandstand, leaving the backstretch oddly vacant. Most everyone thought the only time the horses would run together would be in that first trip down the homestretch, before War Admiral's speed put Seabiscuit away. Seabiscuit gazed at the throng, stirring gently in the sunshine. Wolf studied War Admiral, watching him unravel at the starting line, whirling in circles. After an agonizing interval, Wolf cantered Seabiscuit back to the top of the homestretch. He drew up alongside War Admiral. The flagman raised his arm, and Cassidy poised his finger over the button of Smith's bell. Seabiscuit and War Admiral walked forward together, each rider watching Cassidy. The immense crowd drew its breath. At the last moment, something felt wrong to Wolf. He jerked his right rein and pulled Seabiscuit out. Kurtzinger reined up War Admiral, who bounced up and down in frustration. They lined up again and stepped forward, but this time it was Kurtzinger who reined out. The two horses trotted back to the turn. As they aligned for a third try, Wolf called over to Kurtzinger. "Charlie, we'll never get a go like this. We can't watch the starter and our horses at the same time. Let's walk up there, watching the horses, and when we get even, let's break away ourselves. Cassidy will see us in line, and we'll have to bang the bell." Kurtzinger nodded. The two walked up a third time, each jockey watching the nose of his rival's mount. Wolf tightened his left rein, cocking Seabiscuit's head toward War Admiral to let him focus on his opponent. The horses were perfectly even. Wolf knew that this was it. As they approached Cassidy, Wolf suddenly blurted out, "Charlie, look out, because the Biscuit kicks like hell, and I don't want you or your horse to get hurt." Kurtzinger stared at Wolf in befuddlement, then cleared his mind and trained his eyes back on Seabiscuit's nose. The flagman's hand hovered high in the air. Up in the Howard box, Marcella squeezed her eyes shut. The two noses passed over the line together. The flag flashed down, and the hushed track clanged with the sound of Smith's bell. War Admiral and Seabiscuit burst off the line at precisely the same instant. The gathering wolf that felt in Seabiscuit vented itself in a massive downward push. Lines of muscle along the horse's back, flanks, and belly bulged with the effort, cutting sweeping stripes into his coat. His front end rose upward. Wolf threw himself forward as ballast, thrusting his feet straight back. Seabiscuit reached out and clawed at the ground in front of him, then pushed off again. Beside him, War Admiral scratched and tore at the track, hurling himself forward as hard as he could. Seabiscuit drove over the track, his forelegs pulling the homestretch under his body and flinging it back behind him. Wolf angled him inward, keeping him close to War Admiral, letting him look at his rival. For 30 yards, the two horses hurtled down the homestretch side by side, their cutting, irregular strides settling into long, open lunges, their speed building and building. A pulse of astonishment swept over the crowd. War Admiral, straining with all he had, was losing ground. Seabiscuit's nose forged past, then his throat, then his neck. McCarthy's voice was suddenly shrill. "Seabiscuit is outrunning him!" War Admiral was kicking so hard that his hind legs were nearly thumping into his girth, but he couldn't keep up. An incredible realization sank into Kurtzinger's mind. Seabiscuit is faster. Up in the press box, the California contingent roared. After a 1/16 of a mile, Seabiscuit was half a length ahead and screaming along. He kept pouring it on, flicking his ears forward. The spectators were in a frenzy. As the horses were midway down the first pass through the home stretch, the crowd suddenly gushed over the infield retaining fence 10 feet inside the track rail. Thousands of fans surged toward Wolf and Seabiscuit. Caught at the infield rail, they bent themselves over it, pounding and clapping and flailing their arms in Seabiscuit's path. Seabiscuit, his ears flat and eyes forward, didn't even seem to see them. Neither did Wolf. He had his eyes on the tractor wheel imprint, but War Admiral was on it. Wolf had to get far enough in front to cross ahead of War Admiral and claim it. He let Seabiscuit roll. By the time he and his mount hit the finish line for the first time, they were 2 lengths in front. Wolf looked back, left and right, cocked back his left rein, and slid Seabiscuit across War Admiral's path until he felt the firm ground of the tractor imprint under him. He flattened his back, dropped his chin into Seabiscuit's mane, and flew toward the turn. Behind him, Kurtzinger was shell-shocked. His lips were pulled back and his teeth clenched. In a few seconds, Wolf and Seabiscuit had stolen the track from him, nullifying his post-position edge and his legendary early speed. Kurtzinger didn't panic. War Admiral, though outfooted, was running well and he had a Triple Crown winner's staying power. Seabiscuit was well within reach. Conway had spent weeks training stamina into the horse, while Smith had not done much for Seabiscuit's endurance. Seabiscuit was going much, much too fast for so grueling a race. He couldn't possibly last. Kurtzinger made a new game plan. He would let Seabiscuit exhaust himself on the lead, then run him down. He eased War Admiral over until he was directly behind him, dragging off him, his mount's nose caboosing Seabiscuit's tail. He took hold of his horse and waited. As the two horses banked into the first turn, Wolf remembered Pollard's advice to reel Seabiscuit in. He eased back ever so slightly on the reins and felt the horse's stride come up under him, shortening. His action was little more than a faint gesture, but it meant that Kurtzinger had to either slow down or commit to the outside. Kurtzinger chose the latter, nudging War Admiral out. Seabiscuit cruised into the backstretch on a 1-length lead, with Wolf holding his chin down. War Admiral chased him, his nose nodding up and down behind Seabiscuit's right hip. The blur of faces along the rail thinned, then vanished altogether, and the din from the crowd quieted to a distant rumble. War Admiral and Seabiscuit were alone. With nothing but the long backstretch ahead of him, Wolf carried out Pollard's instructions. Edging Seabiscuit a few feet out from the rail, he tipped his head back and called back to Kurtzinger.
"Hey, get on up here with me. We're supposed to have a horse race here. What are you doing lagging back there?"
Kurtzinger studied the ground ahead. Wolf was dangling the rail slot in front of him, inviting him to take it. Kurtzinger measured the gap between Seabiscuit and the rail and saw that War Admiral was narrow enough to get through. But Kurtzinger knew the Iceman well. He knew that the instant he drove his horse up to full speed and pointed him to the hole, Wolf would drop in toward the rail and slam the door on him, forcing him to change course and lose momentum. Kurtzinger tugged his right rein and moved War Admiral outside. In a storied career of 23 races, through the Triple Crown and virtually every fabled race in the East, no one had ever seen all War Admiral could give. Kurtzinger asked the colt for the full measure. With 5 furlongs to go, he reached back and cracked War Admiral once across the hip. War Admiral responded emphatically. A shout rang out in the crowd. "Here he comes! Here he comes!" Wolf heard the wave of voices and knew what was happening. In a few strides, War Admiral swooped up alongside him, his head pressing Seabiscuit's shoulder. A few more, and he was even. Kurtzinger thought, "I'm going to win it!" The grandstand was shaking. Wolf loosened his fingers and let an inch or two of the rein slide through. Seabiscuit snatched up the rein, lowered his head, and accelerated. Pollard's strategy, Wolf's cunning, and Smith's training had given Seabiscuit a chance in a race he otherwise could not have won. From here on in, it was up to the horse. He cocked an ear toward his rival, listening to him, watching him. He refused to let War Admiral pass. The battle was joined. The horses stretched out over the track. Their strides, each 21 feet in length, fell in perfect sync. They rubbed shoulders and hips, heads snapping up and reaching out together, legs gathering up and unfolding in unison. The poles clipped by, blurring in the rider's peripheral vision. The speed was impossible. At the mile mark, they were nearly a full second faster than a 15-year-old speed record. The track rail hummed up under them and unwound behind. They ripped out of the backstretch and leaned together into the final turn, their strides still rising and falling together. The crowds by the rails thickened, their faces a pointillism of colors, the dappling sound of distinct voices now blending into a sustained shout. The horses strained onward. Kurtzinger began shouting at his horse, his voice whipped away behind him. He pushed on War Admiral's neck and drove with all his strength, sweeping over his mount's right side. War Admiral was slashing at the air, reaching deeper and deeper into himself. The stands were boiling over. A reporter, screaming and jumping, fell halfway out of the press box. His colleagues caught his shirt tails and hauled him back in. In the crowd below, several dozen spectators fainted from the excitement. The horses strained onward, arcing around the far turn and rushing at the crowd. Wolf was still, his eyes trained on War Admiral's head. He could see that Seabiscuit was looking right at his opponent. War Admiral glared back at him, his eyes wide open. Wolf saw Seabiscuit's ears flatten to his head and knew that the moment Fitzsimmons had spoken of was near. One horse was going to crack. As 40,000 voices shouted them on, War Admiral found something more. He thrust his head in front. Wolf glanced at War Admiral's beautiful head, sweeping through the air like a sickle. He could see the depth of the colt's effort in his large amber eye, rimmed in crimson and white. His eye was rolling in its socket as if the horse was in agony, Wolf later recalled. An instant later, Wolf felt a subtle hesitation in his opponent, a wavering. He looked at War Admiral again. The colt's tongue shot out the side of his mouth. Seabiscuit had broken him. Wolf dropped low over the saddle and called into Seabiscuit's ear, asking him for everything he had. Seabiscuit gave it to him. War Admiral tried to answer, clinging to Seabiscuit for a few strides, but it was no use. He slid from Seabiscuit's side as if gravity were pulling him backward. Seabiscuit's ears flipped up. Wolf made a small motion with his hand.
So long, Charlie.
He had coined a phrase that jockeys would use for decades. Galloping low with Wolf flat over his back, Seabiscuit flew into the lane, the clean peninsula of track narrowing ahead as the crowd pushed forward. A steeplechase fence in the infield had collapsed, and a line of men had crashed through the line of police and now stood upright on the inner rail near the wire, bending down toward Seabiscuit and rooting him on. Clem McCarthy's voice was breaking into his microphone.
Seabiscuit by three! Seabiscuit by three!
He had never heard such cheering. Arms waved and mouths gaped open in credulity as Seabiscuit came on, his ears wagging. Thousands of hands reached out from the infield, stretching to brush his shoulders as he blew past. When he could no longer hear War Admiral's hooves beating the track, Wolf looked back. He saw the black form some 35 feet behind, still struggling to catch him. He had been wrong about War Admiral. He was game. Wolf felt a stab of empathy. "I saw something in the Admiral's eyes that was pitiful," he would say later. "He looked all broken up. I don't think he will be good for another race. Horses, mister, can have crushed hearts just like humans." The Iceman straightened out and rode for the wire, his face down. Seabiscuit sailed into history 4 lengths in front, running easy. Behind him, pandemonium ensued. Seabiscuit's wake seemed to create an irresistible vacuum, sucking the fans in behind him. Thousands of men, women, and children vaulted over the rails, poured onto the track, and began running after him. Police dashed over the track, but the fans simply ran past them, leaping and clapping. Ahead of them all, Wolf stood like a titan in the irons. He cupped his hand around his mouth and shouted something back at Kurtzinger. His words were lost in the cheering. Up in the Howard box, Marcella's eyes opened and filled with tears. Howard, completely overcome, stood up and whooped. They smiled and bowed as hundreds of voices called out to them. In his box nearby, Samuel Riddle lowered his binoculars, turned to the Howards, and smiled weakly. His eyes were wide and shining with the shock of it. He hurried from his box. "It was a good race," he said. The crowd solemnly cleared a path for him. One or two people put a hand on his shoulder as he passed. Marcella sank back down, disconcerted. Howard wanted to take her to the winner's circle, but she decided to stay where she was. Tears were streaming down her face. She sat, drying her eyes with a handkerchief and laughing at herself. Howard burst out of the box and sprinted downstairs as fast as he could go, babbling and shaking hands with everyone he saw. He dashed onto the track and immediately disappeared in the swirling masses of revelers. Smith and Vanderbilt joined him, and the three of them fought to stay on their feet as reporters and fans pushed and pulled on them. Howard, unable to control his jubilation, jumped up and down with the fans. Police ran every which way. The final race time lit up the tote board. A second roar erupted from the crowd. Seabiscuit had run the mile in 3/16 in 1:56.35. No horse in Pimlico's fabled and lengthy history, through thousands of races dating back to just after the Civil War, had ever run the distance so fast. Wolf turned Seabiscuit and cantered him back into the mob. He was wrung out. "All in for breath," said McCarthy, "and he's almost as white as the sleeves of his jacket." Wolf pulled Seabiscuit up to the grandstand, and the crowd enveloped them, shouting, "Georgie! Georgie!" McCarthy shoved his way up to the horse and propped a microphone on Seabiscuit's withers. Wolf bent to it. "I wish my old pal Red had been on him instead of me," he said in his easy drawl. "See ya, Red." Hundreds of hands touched Wolf's legs and stroked Seabiscuit's coat. The horse stood quietly in the center of the chaos, his tail in the air and his ribs heaving in and out as the waves of fans pushed up to his sides. Smith elbowed his way up, and someone asked him for a statement.
I said mine on the track, the trainer said.
The police fought their way into them, then formed a square and drove the crowd outward, leaving Smith standing beside his horse. Pumpkin bulled in with a stable hand on his back. The police opened a narrow avenue into the winner's circle. Smith grasped Seabiscuit's rein and led his grand little horse down the avenue of guards. Smith kept his eyes straight ahead, chin up, his face proud and sober. He led Seabiscuit to Howard, who patted the horse's nose and beamed. In the winner's circle, the police cordon gave way and the reporters and fans pressed in again, wedging Seabiscuit and his handlers into the corner. Smith lifted a blanket of yellow chrysanthemums over the horse's neck. Unperturbed by the near riot around him, Seabiscuit began gently plucking flowers off the wreath and eating them. Howard tugged a single chrysanthemum from the blanket. The crowd begged for souvenir blossoms. Smith pulled a flower out for himself, and in a rare moment of exuberance, heaved a whole blanket into the crowd. A happy yell went up, and the flowers vanished. Kurtzinger steered War Admiral around the celebration and pulled him up in front of the grandstand. Kurtzinger sagged in the saddle. War Admiral had run the greatest race of his life, running by far his fastest time for the distance. But he had not been good enough. Conway pushed his way through the fans and emerged in front of his colt. He examined his legs, found them sound and cool, and turned away. A reporter asked him for a statement.
No, no, he said. Nothing to say.
Dazed, he disappeared into the mob. Kurtzinger smiled bravely and slid from the saddle. He uncinched it and pulled it from War Admiral's back, then stood and looked at his horse for a moment. He stepped forward and whispered something in the horse's ear, then walked away. A groom threw a black and yellow blanket over War Admiral's back. The police cleared a path for him, and War Admiral, his head low, was led back to the barn to the lonely clapping of a handful of fans. He would run in two more minor races, winning both, then go on to become one of the breed's great sires. Wolf slid to the ground and stood with one hand on his hip, smiling confidently as Vanderbilt handed Howard the silver victory vase. Someone dragged Smith over to the mic, and he muttered something about credit being due to horse and rider. The final odds lit up the board, and Howard burst out laughing. The crowd applauded. It took 15 minutes to clear a path wide enough for Seabiscuit to get out of the winner's circle. As Howard whirled off with the reporters, Wolf and Smith picked their way back to the jockey's room, trailed by well-wishers. They stopped in the doorway. Kurtzinger was already inside.
I hate to beat Kurtzinger, Wolf said. The cleverest jockey I ever competed against.
The reporters buzzed around him with questions about Seabiscuit.
He's the best horse in the world, he said. He proved that today.
Smith allowed himself a small smile. Wolf turned to him.
If only Red could have seen Biscuit run today, he said. Yeah, said Smith, his smile fading. But I kind of think the redhead was riding along with you, George.
Wolf went into the jockey's room. Down the bench, Kurtzinger was pulling off his boots and quietly crying. Someone gently asked him what happened.
What can I say? We just couldn't make it, he said. The admiral came to him and looked him in the eye. But that other horse refused to quit. We gave all we had. It just wasn't good enough.
Smith went back to the barn to see his horse. He spent a few quiet moments with him, his arm thrown over his neck, the horse's head by his chest. Wolf dressed and joined them. He stood by the stall door, watching Seabiscuit settle in. The horse felt good. He trotted around the stall, playing. Wolf thought he looked as if he hadn't run the race yet. The Howards packed up carloads of reporters and brought them all to their hotel room. In exactly 2 months, Seabiscuit would turn 6, relatively old for a racehorse, and an age at which most stallions were already at stud. The newsman wanted to know if Howard was ready to retire his horse. Howard shook his head. Beating War Admiral had always been a secondary ambition. Charles and Marcella's greatest wish was for Seabiscuit to win the Santa Anita Handicap. The horse would stay in training. When Howard finally let them go, the reporters went home and filled out their ballots for championship honors. Seabiscuit was, at last, Horse of the Year. Smith arrived at the barn at 4 the next morning. The reporters, drowsing in the barn aisles, jumped up when they saw him. For once in his life, Smith couldn't stop smiling. "That War Admiral is a better horse than I thought he was," he quipped as he walked into the shed row. "I had been sure we'd beat him by 10 lengths, and it was only 4. It's funny that nobody'd believe me when I said this horse could run." As he approached Seabiscuit's stall, he fell silent, walking tiptoe. He gently opened the door and peered inside. Seabiscuit was a dark lump, half buried in the straw, dead to the world. Smith stepped back and quietly closed the door. "He's earned his rest, all right," he breathed. Up in Massachusetts, Pollard greeted reporters with a rhyme. "The weather was clear, the track fast, War Admiral broke first and finished last." David Alexander came in with congratulations. "Well, what did you think of it?" Alexander asked. "He did just what I thought he'd do." "What was that?" "He made a rear admiral out of War Admiral." An envelope from Wolf arrived. Inside was $1,500, half the jockey's purse. Part 3. Chapter 20. All 4 of his legs are broken. In mid-November, after 5 months in bed, Pollard emerged from Winthrop Hospital, stabbing at the ground with his crutches and swinging his legs along. He returned to the world a changed man. His body was still wasted. His face was withered and old. His career was dead. He was homeless. And because he had no insurance, he hadn't a cent left to his name. The Howards asked him to come live with them at Ridgewood. Pollard accepted. His doctor drove him to the airport, and Agnes rode along with them. Pollard promised her that once he was established, he would send for her and they would marry. Agnes watched him bump up to the plane and wondered if he would live to see her again. When Pollard arrived in California, he went to Tanforan to see the racetrackers again. His appearance stunned everyone. On the backstretch, his old contract trainer, Russ McGurr, saw the young man whom he had once purchased as a bug boy for a bridle, a saddle, and a few sacks of oats. McGurr burst into tears as they embraced. Pollard settled in at Ridgewood. He was determined to heal and get back to riding, so he tossed away his crutches and tried to walk. It was a mistake. On one of the Ridgewood hills, he set his foot down wrong in a ditch hidden in the grass. The leg came down at an oblique angle and snapped. The Howards rushed Pollard to the hospital Charles had built in memory of his lost son, and called Doc Babcock, the same country physician who had tried in vain to save Frankie. In examining Pollard's leg, Babcock discovered that the Massachusetts doctors hadn't managed the setting and rehabilitation of Pollard's leg properly. The leg would have to be rebroken, but this time, he felt, it would heal. Pollard knew what suffering lay in store for him, but didn't hesitate. He underwent the procedure. Soon afterward, Wolf drove from Maryland back to California, where he arrived at Tanforan to general applause. Someone told him that Pollard had again been hospitalized, and Wolf was crestfallen. He got back in his car and headed north to Willits, where he spent several days visiting with Pollard. November rolled through Maryland, bringing with it sheets of ice. The track at Pimlico became a virtual skating rink, and Smith limited Seabiscuit's outings to walks around the shed rows. The ice didn't melt, and the horse began gaining weight. On December 1st, Smith walked out of the barn and stooped over the dirt racecourse. The track was glazed in ice. He stood there a while, quietly humming.